Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm your host, James Rogers, and this is the History Hit Warfare podcast. Each week, twice a week, I bring you brand new original military histories with some of the world's leading experts. And then once a week, I delve deep into the History Hit archives to pull out an episode that I know deserves some more attention. Now, if you're liking what you hear so far, then drop us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, because it really helps us to get out there to everyone who loves history. And so many of you have done it already that we're jumping up the charts in Apple Podcasts as one of the leading history podcasts out there at the moment. So thank you all so much for that. This episode is a real corker. It's about when Fidel Castro came to Harlem. Simon Hall joined Dan on the podcast to talk about this trip to New York in September 1960. Castro was based at Harlem's Teresa Hotel, and he met with a succession, an endless line of political and cultural luminaries. These included everyone from Malcolm X and Nikita Khrushchev through to Allen Ginsberg. Dan and Simon discussed the coming together of these revolutionaries as they embraced the politics of anti-imperialism, racial equality, and leftist revolutions. I know you're going to absolutely love this episode. And if there's something you specifically want to hear on the podcast, then remember, you can always get in contact on Instagram at James Rogers History, on Twitter at HistoryHitWW2, and you can email us directly on the email address warfare@historyhit.com. But here is Dan and Simon on when Fidel came to Harlem.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Dan. It's really great to be here.
You've done that thing that I love it when historians do. You've found that little 10-day period that just, with the most extraordinary cast list you can imagine. What was the background to this famous visit of Fidel Castro to New York City?
So he's flown in for the 15th General Assembly of the United Nations, which is like one of the great sort of set-piece diplomatic moments of the post-war. The post-war period, and he's gone there, I think, to make some mischief and have some fun.
Look, can I just first of all ask, because I'm so fascinated by the history of the UN. People today just they don't realise it was very briefly. It was a kind of global parliament. I mean, it mattered. People, JFK, Eisenhower, those guys sweated what happened in on the assembly floor, didn't they?
Yeah, it mattered, and it mattered in a way that it doesn't seem to matter at the moment, which is telling, and it particularly mattered in September of 1960, because it was a moment when more than a dozen newly independent African countries were about to join the United Nations. And this was seen both as a hugely symbolic moment in the history of the end of European empire, but also these countries, their allegiances were sort of up for grabs in the Cold War contest between the United States and the West and the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc. So the United Nations seemed to matter very much in the autumn of 1960.
And what's Fidel's reputation? What's the reality of his position in Cuba and his approach to ruling there? And then what's his reputation in the West and also different communities, not just in the West, but even within the city of New York?
Yeah, so Fidel had seized power. His revolution had succeeded in ousting Batista in January of 1959. And it was a kind of a revolution that had sort of thrilled people, lots of people around the world, including many liberals and leftists in Western Europe and in the United States. But as his government had kind of begun to kind of consolidate its hold on Cuba, support among many white liberals basically started to drift away. They'd been particularly alarmed by two things. One, a kind of flurry of sort of show trials and executions in the early months of the revolution, and then an increasingly sort of independent economic policy, which had seen the government in Cuba nationalise and expropriate companies that were owned by, particularly by American businessmen. And so by the time we get to the autumn of 1960, his stock is definitely falling in lots of among many constituencies in the United States and in Western Europe. But he's still very popular among leftists, and particularly among African Americans. And that's because within just a few weeks of taking power in January of 1959, he'd committed his government to eliminating racial discrimination and segregation on the island. And so this was particularly kind of exciting because Cuba was just 90 miles off the coast of the segregated South. And Fidel's kind of boldness contrasted very sharply with the Eisenhower administration's kind of caution when it came to American race relations. Eisenhower sort of basically said to African Americans, you know, I support your demands for greater freedom and equality, but you need to be patient. There was a certain lack of empathy, I suppose, with the increasing urgency of demands in the United States for racial reform and real change.
And I love the popular response to Fidel landing. Paint everyone the picture of what happens when Fidel gets off his plane and heads into downtown.
The American government is really very unhappy that he's come to New York. They'd much rather he wasn't there. They place all of these security restrictions on him that mean that he's not able to leave the island of Manhattan. He's kind of manhandled a bit when he gets off the plane by the security, the American security, when he attempts to go over and greet a crowd of supporters who've assembled at Idlewild Airport, which is modern day JFK, to kind of greet him. And then as he drives in to Manhattan, there are quite a lot of supporters, Cuban American supporters of the revolution, people of South American origin who are Latin American origin who are supportive of the revolution. African Americans are out, and they gather outside his hotel in Midtown, the Shelbourne Hotel, to kind of cheer him. So he's and they did this despite the fact that the weather is filthy; it's pouring with rain all afternoon. But they're there on the streets to kind of greet him and catch a glimpse of him.
Does he enjoy this? I mean, how does this impact on him?
Yeah, I think obviously whenever he sees people who are cheering him, it that's kind of grist to his mill. Really, he's pleased by it. He's not pleased by the American security presence. He gets very annoyed when they, you know, he tries to get out of his car at one point at the airport, and they basically force him back in, and that puts him in a bit of a bad mood. But the sight of the supporters is definitely one that puts a smile on his face.
But the one person who didn't support him was that apparently the hotel. You tell me all about the hotel owner was not a big fan.
No, so I mean the Cubans had a real tough time in actually securing accommodations in New York. The original hotel they were going to stay in cancelled the reservation when the Fidel announced that he would be heading the delegation and bringing a much larger contingent to New York. And then basically no hotel would accommodate them. And it started to become a bit of a diplomatic embarrassment for the United States. So the State Department, together with the UN, basically put pressure on the owner of this hotel in Midtown, the Shelbourne Hotel, a guy called Edward Spatz. And they convinced him to accommodate the Cubans. But Spatz is an anti-communist, and he's a great American patriot, and he makes it very clear to the press that he's only taking in the Cubans sort of under sufferance, really. And he kind of makes it clear to the Cubans as well when they arrive that he doesn't really, he's not really particularly happy that they're staying there. So there's a moment when they ask, you know, he puts a big, huge American flag outside the hotel to kind of burnish his patriotic credentials, and when they ask if they can fly the Cuban flag, he just says, you know, no way. And he tells the press that he hates the Cubans. So it's probably not so much of a surprise that the stay at the Shelbourne is a short and relatively unhappy one.
He threatens to sleep outside. He's like, yeah, I've been sleeping in under the stars during the revolution. I'm cool with that.
Yeah, so even before he gets to New York, he's said, you know, we might end up having to sleep in Central Park, but that's fine. We're a mountain people. We're used to the open air. And then there's all these rumours flying around shortly after the Cubans have checked in that says that they're plucking chickens and cooking them in their hotel rooms and stubbing out their cigars in the on the expensive furniture. And so Spatz demands a $10,000 additional security deposit and then refuses a Cuban government bond on the grounds that it looks dodgy. And this really is the trigger for Fidel to basically storm out of the hotel, head straight to the United Nations headquarters, complains to Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General, about the terrible, insulting treatment of his delegation, threatens to sleep in the UN Rose Garden if an alternative can't be found, and then after a couple of hours at the United Nations, ends up relocating to the Hotel Teresa in Harlem, the so-called Waldorf of Harlem.
And where he's more popular uptown, isn't he? Because then that's when it all turns into a sort of, well, a whole different scene.
Yeah, he's enormously popular. It causes huge excitement. News of his move to Harlem spreads. So even before he gets there, there are several thousand people crowded onto the streets around the hotel, cheering, waving flags. And basically, that's the scene that repeats itself night after night. Crowds gather every day to try to catch a glimpse of Castro, and also to catch a glimpse of many of his high profile guests who come calling. And so, yeah, he gets a very warm reception in Harlem itself.
Tell me about those guests, because I mean, this is the thing that's just completely fascinating. And for that few weeks. I mean, people often talk about New York being the world's capital, but it was just everyone who was anyone was in New York, and he seemed to be one of the big players.
Yeah, I mean, his very first guest is Malcolm X, who arrives just a few, maybe less than an hour after Fidel checks in at the Teresa, and that really sets the tone of his stay there. So, his second guest is Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union. NASA goes there. Nehru goes there. On the evening of September the 22nd, there's a great sort of gala reception held at the Teresa for him. And you get the kind of great and the good of the worlds of kind of politics, culture, the black freedom struggle who are there. People like Allen Ginsberg, C. Wright Mills, the New Left sociologist, the Magnum photographer, Henri Cartier-Bresson. So you have, you know, the great and the good of the, not just the United States, but kind of global figures there too. I mean, the British theatre critic Kenneth Tynan is there at the reception. So it's kind of a great moment in the history of this stay, but also great kind of becomes an iconic moment in the history of the kind of wider 1960s. For a while, the whole world's attention is really on the comings and goings at the Hotel Teresa. I mean, Fidel really steals the show.
What did Tudor men like their women to look like?
They should have broad shoulders, fleshy arms, fleshy legs, and broad hips.
What did 17th century Londoners think of coffee?
A syrup of soot and the essence of old shoes.
And what did executioners wear?
A lot of these guys, they were clothes horses because it's a big public spectacle. All the eyes are on you.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and in my podcast, Not Just the Tudors, we talk about everything from monasteries to the Medici, sex to spying, wardrobes to witch trials. Not, in other words, just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Subscribe from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Apart from the sort of just creating a good vibe, what did these anti-imperialists like NASA and Fidel, did they have anything in common? Was there anything constructive? Or were they there for the Instagram shots?
Yeah, I'm not sure they were there just for the Instagram shots, although there are some absolutely wonderful photographs, loads of wonderful photographs of this whole series of events that take place. I think Fidel wants... He wants to be seen with these people because it helps to burnish his own claims to be a kind of leader of the global anti-imperialist movement. When it comes to NASA, they do have things in common. So the Cubans had admired NASA for kind of standing up to the British and the French in 1956 during the Suez Crisis. And so they did have a kind of shared interest there. But the meeting with NASA doesn't go as well as it might have done. They're two very different characters. I mean, Fidel is always in his olive green battle fatigues. His suite at the Hotel Teresa is extremely messy. And NASA is a very smooth, a very polished, extremely smart, always very immaculately dressed and turned out. And NASA is sort of appalled by the surroundings in the Hotel Teresa when he goes to visit Fidel. But they also don't get along brilliantly. There's a moment when NASA presents Fidel with a beautiful silver tea service as a gift, and Castro is can't contain his disappointment at not being given a crocodile. And NASA is kind of, he's like, well, there are only four crocodiles in Egypt. They're all in the zoo. I mean, and for days after that meeting, he's overheard sort of muttering to himself, you know, a crocodile. Fidel gets on much better with Nehru, where they do seem to bond very tightly over the kind of granular detail of how to do land reform. So they do seem to share a common interest in that. But a lot of it is about the symbolism. It's not just the photos, but it's the kind of the wider symbolism of crafting this kind of anti-imperialist movement and anti-imperialist moment, I suppose.
Yeah, because you think of the transnational architecture of post-Second World War, the UN, the World Bank, the IMF, is built by Churchill and Truman and these figures from the Western powers. This must have felt in Harlem. This must have felt like a sort of alternative, with great potential, kind of global, a transnational system, but one that wasn't didn't run through Washington DC and Whitehall.
Yeah, and I think there'd been a sort of an early indication of that. I think it was in 1955 at the Bandung Conference in Indonesia, which was the sort of the first coming together of the so-called non-aligned nations that ultimately become the non-aligned movement, a kind of an attempt to kind of bring together this new force in global politics. And this is in the autumn of 1960, this is, as I said earlier, is given real added traction by the influx of so many newly independent countries to the United Nations, including the likes of Nigeria and Senegal and stuff. So there's a real feeling, I think, that this new force, or this growing force, can really make a difference, that it can maybe challenge the bipolar system, the kind of the Cold War contest between the West and the communist powers, that it can pull together the kind of the interests and the power of these new nations and really make a difference. So it's quite exciting in that sense, I think.
And then it's really exciting. Speaking of non-aligned, is that Castro was trying to ride a couple of different horses there, right? Because he was also, what was his relationship like with Khrushchev, the Soviet premier?
Yeah, so he meets Khrushchev for the first time in Harlem. Khrushchev makes a point of going to the Hotel Teresa to meet with Fidel, who had offered to go down to the Soviet mission on Park Avenue. But Khrushchev wants to go to Harlem to make two points, really. One, to show solidarity with the Cubans who have been allegedly mistreated in Midtown, but also to draw attention to America's race problem and to cause embarrassment for the Eisenhower administration. And the two get on really well. They don't meet for very long that first time. The meeting lasts for about half an hour, but they emerge onto the sidewalk kind of beaming. They share a kind of very enthusiastic, but because of the, you know, Khrushchev is very short and quite rotund, and Fidel is extremely tall and thin, they share an awkward but enthusiastic embrace on the sidewalk outside the Teresa. When Fidel enters the General Assembly later that day, Khrushchev makes a big thing of getting up and going over and greeting him again and having another kind of back-slapping embrace with him. Khrushchev is even extremely patient when Fidel turns up about 45 minutes late for dinner at the Soviet mission a few days later, and is really at pains to put Castro at ease and to be as relaxed as possible. So the chemistry, the personal chemistry between the two of them is very good and is on show for the whole world. So yeah, at the same time that Fidel is seeking to kind of burnish his credentials as a leader of the kind of anti-imperialist global South, he's also growing ever closer to the Soviet Union.
And did Khrushchev say, do you want some tactical nuclear missiles on your island?
He didn't say, as far as I know, he didn't say it right then, no. But obviously, a year or so later after the Bay of Pigs invasion, that's when he does. But he does make it clear, and has in fact, the Soviet Union has made it clear in the run-up to the General Assembly that they're supportive of the Cuban Revolution. And they do talk about, you know, if Cuba is attacked by the United States, that they will, you know, use their own rockets to protect Cuba. So they've already started to intimate that they're prepared to support the Cuban Revolution.
What about the African Americans in Harlem and beyond? What is the importance of the visit there?
I think it's important symbolically. It's not that everybody who's out on the street cheering for Fidel is a kind of diehard supporter of the Cuban Revolution or a potential communist or communist sympathizer. Part of it is they're just really excited and pleased that the world spotlight has been shone on Harlem, an area which is usually kind of cut off from wider public view. There's a kind of a general glee, I suppose, that the American government has been embarrassed by all of this. There's a rumor that does the rounds that says that, you know, when Fidel said he was going to move up to Harlem, that immediately the American government offered to pay for the Cubans to stay in another hotel in Midtown for free. And it's a rumor that's not true, but the fact that it's so popular and it's so widely communicated in Harlem kind of indicates, I think, the kind of glee that the African-American community there takes with the evident embarrassment of the State Department and the Eisenhower administration is suffering. But they also know that that Fidel and his government are committed to ending racial segregation on Cuba, that they are committed to racial equality. And I think the fact that he's prepared to stay in Harlem and to show that kind of solidarity is symbolically very important, and kind of on an emotional level is deeply kind of appreciated. And there's a kind of a reciprocal sense of this sort of solidarity that's in the air, really. I mean, on the, I think it's Wednesday the 22nd when Eisenhower speaks himself at the United Nations, and then he hosts a lunch for the delegations of the Latin American countries, but deliberately excludes Fidel Castro. So Castro goes back to the Hotel Teresa and treats the black employees of the hotel to lunch, and of course invites the press there to take photographs and makes a big play about how he's not offended at not being invited to the grand lunch with Eisenhower. He's much more happy and honoured to have lunch with the humble people of Harlem.
What a player. I mean, was there any possibility that there could have been rapprochement? I mean, this was a trip from Fidel to the US, and we see the Bay of Pigs invasion to try and topple Fidel within months. Was there any suggestion that this visit was a missed opportunity?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, that sort of counterfactual. I think there's certainly a point where you could see Cuban-US relations not ending up as difficult and as tense and as hostile as they eventually became. By the autumn of 1960, things have got pretty bad. And certainly what happens in Harlem and in New York in September, you know, just really confirms the Eisenhower administration's conviction that they can have no rapprochement with Fidel or no meaningful kind of way of working things out. But there's sort of an inflexibility on both sides, really. I mean, I think there's a nice contrast, really, between Eisenhower, who just sort of refuses to meet Fidel, dismisses him in private as a madman, and with Harold Macmillan, who, when he enters the General Assembly, he makes a big play of going over to Nasser and shaking him by the hand and being friendly with him, even though Britain has been humiliated a few years earlier by Nasser and Egypt, and even though Macmillan had been one of the leading hawks in the Suez crisis. And I do kind of think, you know, if Eisenhower had just been a little bit more flexible, you know, it was never going to happen, but if he'd gone over to Fidel and kind of shaken him by the hand and said, you know, maybe we should try to, meet quietly and try to work some things out, you know, history might have taken a different turn, but it was never really on the cards, I don't think.
As it was, moving away from the counterfactual, back in the actual historical record, what's the main legacy, do you think, of this remarkable 10 days?
Yeah, so I think it is a key moment in the history of the Cold War, because it kind of cements this growing closeness between the Soviet Union and Cuba, which is a really important relationship in its own right, but also indicates how the kind of wider focus of the Cold War is shifting away from Europe to the countries of the global south, a Cold War which is going to focus on Latin America, on Africa, and on Asia. I think it's also, I think there's something about the kind of anarchic sort of rip it up style of this trip, which I think sets the tone for the rest of the decade. And the way in particular in which Fidel is kind of fated by the kind of the great and the good of the American kind of left is a kind of an early sign of that kind of politics of so-called third worldism and radical chic, which becomes really important during the 1960s, particularly during the later 1960s with the support for the Viet Cong and the support for the Black Panthers, for example. So I think those are probably the two biggest kind of consequences, the kind of Cold War relationship and the kind of the kind of mood music, the style, the way that the 60s kind of unfold as we go forward from this from these extraordinary 10 days.
Well, the book is called, appropriately,
10 Days in Harlem, Fidel Castro and the Making of the 1960s.
Go and get it, everybody. It's brilliant. Simon, thank you very much for coming back on the podcast. You were on years ago talking about 1956. And so it feels to me like you feel free not to answer this, but you're heading on an unstoppable trajectory towards 1968. That's what it feels like from this point.
Well, we'll see, yeah, but it's great to be back on, so thanks for inviting me.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.